It's Philosophy Talk.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
What is fear?
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
If one candidate's appealing to your fears and the other one's appealing to your hopes, you better vote for the person who wants you to think and hope.
Hey, neighbor, let me give you some advice. The Russians are about to pulverize us in our sleep tonight. That is if the crazy Arabs hold the rights. Don't get us first, and the fire will rain down from the sky. The fire will rain down from the sky.
Is fear the engine of civilization?
Our guest is Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea.
Remember what the wise man said, there's nothing to fear.
Fear, coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, fear.
You must not fear, Ken. Fear is the mind killer, the reason killer. Fear is a little death that brings total obliteration. Face your fear, Ken.
Oh, thanks for the advice, John, but we're not really talking about that kind of fear. We're talking about the use and abuse of fear as a political tool.
Well, you mean we're going to discuss the way politicians stoke our fears to mobilize us into action, to stifle dissent, and to justify all sorts of repressive politics?
Yeah, that's one of the kinds of things we're going to talk about. But you make it sound as if the political use of fear is always illegitimate. But some things are worth fearing. And fear can sometimes lead us to do the right thing. We fear the consequences of global warming, so we take actions now to prevent it from happening.
Well, there's support for your love of fear in the philosophical tradition. Thomas Hobbes, one of the founding fathers of social contract tradition, claimed that fear drove us to form societies. He claimed that in the state of nature, without society, human life is solitary, nasty, brutish, and short, because everyone fears one another, because everyone is at war with everyone else.
So to end this war of all against all, Hobbes says, we have to enter into civil society and surrender all power to invoke fear, to the state. So for Hobbes, fear is actually a good thing because it's the glue that binds people together.
Exactly. Hobbes thought all power should be concentrated into the hands of the state, the Leviathan, so that we no longer need to fear each other. But what about the state itself? Now we have to fear it.
Well, right. Of course we should fear the state. But Hobbes seems to think that's a good thing. Because instead of a thousand little cockroaches constantly nipping at each other, we jointly surrender power to the big kahuna of the state, and we charge it with keeping order among us. Cross up the state, and you're really in trouble now.
That sounds like tyranny. There needs to be some limit on the state's ability to use the instruments of fear to impress its will upon us. Otherwise, the state will just run amok. The tyrants of the 20th century, Stalin, Hitler, Mao, Franco, Pol Pot, and many, many imitators. They should have taught us that.
Well, I agree with you that a state with the exclusive power to exercise the instruments of fear would be a really ugly sight. But, you know, a state with no power to cause fear would be, well, a wimp of a state. What would the law be, for example, without the backing of force? What would a state's inherent right of self-defense amount to without a kick-butt army to back up that right?
But fear leads to a lot of bad stuff. I mean, here in California, we've got this three strikes and you're out because of our fear of criminals. It really doesn't do much to diminish crime, but it's practically bankrupt the state. I mean, fear's a dangerous tool.
I agree with you about that. And think of the entire war on drugs, not just here in California, but across the country. It's turned the U.S. into the world's biggest prison house, but I can't see that it's done much to solve our drug problem fundamentally. And there's a general point. When social problems are framed in ways that are intended to maximize and exploit our fears, we're liable to take actions that are way out of proportion to the problem.
Well, you see, I was right. Fear really is the reason killer. A mind seized with fear makes us do all kinds of irrational, crazy things, way out of proportion to the dangers posed by the objects of our fear.
Which leads to the question, John, just what role should fear play in our political discourse? How do we distinguish legitimate from illegitimate appeals to fear? And could there be a politics based more on hope than on fear?
Well, in a little bit, we'll be able to put these questions and more to our guest, Corey Robin. He's the author of Fear, the History of a Political Idea.
And we'd also like some help from our fearless listeners. The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
But before that, our roving philosophical reporter, Rena Palta, gets some firsthand advice on the political uses of fear. She files this report.
Politicians have one big thing on their minds at all times.
Vote for Pedro.
Vote for me.
Vote for Pedro.
Winning elections. This is one of the guys who helps them do it.
I'm Jim Ross. I'm a political consultant.
Ross has worked for San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, Oregon Governor Ted Klingoski, and current Oregon gubernatorial candidate Bill Bradbury. Ross says understanding politics means embracing the fact that no one makes purely rational decisions. And that's not a bad thing. It's just how we're wired.
People make rational decisions based on an emotional response. You know, so they will take a piece of a policy or an issue, and they'll make a decision, a rational decision, based on how that makes them feel. So I would say everything in politics, at some level, is based on an emotional appeal or an emotional response.
And one of the most instinctive human emotions is fear. It has a storied place in American history. Politicians use fear to energize voters, but they also warn against its power.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Whether it's Franklin Roosevelt trying to get people over their fear and saying, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear ourselves, to, you know, the famous Lyndon B. Johnson ad with the little girl counting down and pulling the leaves off a daisy and then a nuclear explosion.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
To even this last election cycle, presidential election cycle, with Hillary Clinton and the 2 a.m. call.
There's a phone in the White House and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world. Who do you want answering the phone?
So fear has been a kind of overriding trend in modern American politics.
But fear can be a useful tool in drawing attention to an issue that's not gaining enough steam on its own. Issues like
global warming.
This ad by the Environmental Defense Fund shows a barreling train.
Some say irreversible consequences are 30 years away. 30 years? That won't affect me.
As the train draws near, we see it's about to hit a pouting little girl. Political consultant Jim Ross says that Save the Whales and other sorts of aspirational messages have advanced the environmental movement somewhat. But positioning global warming as a crisis and giving it a sense of urgency has pushed it more towards the mainstream consciousness.
There's a lot of people that have real fear, but others, they just see it as a, you know, it's a crisis. It's something that we need to fix. It's more the difference between, oh, you know, I got up this morning and my car won't start, to, oh, I'm going down a hill and my brakes don't work.
But visceral emotions can't sustain over time. Which is why, Ross says, advocates of climate change policy have changed their message. They've turned to marketing the fact that green innovations could help the economy.
That's, I think, with fear, the problem as a political communications tool is it's a one that only works for a very short period of time. So you can use it for a while to accelerate a debate or accelerate attention onto an issue. But eventually you're gonna have to insert an aspirational message of some sort into that, into the mix there, or people will get burned out and they'll just ignore it.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Rena Palta.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Corey Robin. He's professor of political science at the City University of New York. He's author of Fear, the History of a Political Idea. Corey, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
So, Corey, how did you get interested in doing research on fear as a political idea? I mean, did you grow up in some place where people were seized by fear?
No, not really. I grew up in suburban New York, so it wasn't exactly a fearful place. I was a graduate student. I was interested in the topic and from an intellectual point of view in the history of the way it had been thought. But I actually got involved in a union struggle. I was the leader of an effort to organize the teaching assistants at Yale University. This is during the 1990s. And as it happens, we ended up going out on strike in the mid-90s. I led that strike, and it brought down a wave of recriminations upon many of the people who were striking, including myself. I ended up having two advisors revise letter of recommendations, and I had to reconstitute my dissertation committee. And this wouldn't be just of interest to sort of academics, because it ended up being a big federal case with the government, leading to a change in labor law. So I had a real sort of firsthand taste. And if I could just add something to that, it's what produced two of the things that I think about with fear, which I think are important for your listeners. One is that experience was not involving the government. This was private actors, a university, private employers. And I think we make a mistake oftentimes focusing so much on government and politicians and people like that. And the second thing is that all the cases you all have been talking about on the show so far are of uniting a community against an other, you know, whether it's terrorism or climate change or so forth. What I'm interested in, and what I think is far more common, is when a community is divided within itself, people with power struggling with people with less power, and the fear that's generated through that struggle. That's not a uniting mobilizing message. That's much more of a divisive, repressive message. And I think both of those things are much more common about the politics of fear than we realize.
Well, okay, that's a good point. But I still want to get your opinion on this. I mean, in our nation's history, a lot of times we've been gripped by fear. I mean, when I grew up, the Red Scare. And the H-bomb, Nixon's silent majority and its fear of liberalism, the left's reaction to Reagan, there were going to be homeless people everywhere and we were going to go to war everywhere. Would you say that fearfulness is a normal state of our political life or an abnormal state?
Oh, I think it's pretty normal. I think the question really about fear is just how visible it is. But the fact of the matter is, the reason it's normal is that fear is, in politics, a function of and an emanation of power and conflict. And I believe, and I think most political scientists believe, that power and conflict are the norms of politics. That's the way politics works.
But you might think that politics works like this. We're a community. We have shared problems. We're going to deliberate together about our shared problems. We're going to reach mutually endorsable solutions. All the structures of democracy are supposed to enable us to deliberate together about how we'll lead our lives together. But if fear is the normal state of our politics and it's divisive, I mean, I take your point that sometimes it divides the polity one segment from another, right? It's the fear of the black hordes coming into our schools through busing and all that stuff, right? I mean, how does this fear and this idea of democracy as collective deliberation, how does that go together at all?
I think that idea of collective deliberation is something that a certain school of academic political theory believes is the norm, but it's not the case. The great questions in politics are always fundamental questions about the division of power and who's going to have it and how can it be either more equally shared or unequally shared. Think of the great advance. I mean, ironically, it's actually related to democracy in the following sense, that the great advances of democracy, the freedom of the slaves, women getting the right to vote, the civil rights movement, the labor movement in the 1930s, these were all movements designed to try to make things more equal in this country, to overcome a fear that was constraining a good half, if not a majority of the population, from achieving its share of happiness. So it's not that they're unrelated. It's just that they're not quite related in the sense that people think. That I think that the real guts of a democracy is when people are striving to gain more power and trying to overcome the fear that has previously constrained them.
We're going to have to dig into this. This is a fascinating issue you've raised. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about fear with Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea.
In our next segment, we're going to take a closer look at the nature of fear. We're going to ask how fear affects our decision-making for good and ill. Is it always irrational to make decisions on the basis of our fears? Or can it sometimes lead us to do the right thing and for the right reason? You can join us by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Striking the balance between emotion and reason, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in!
Fear. Sometimes it's a good thing. If you're a little pig and there's a wolf at the door, fear is probably a pretty good thing for you to feel. Sometimes it's a bad thing. What happens when it's the tool of politicians, academic or political? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And this is Philosophy Talk. We're talking about fear as a political instrument. What do you fear? Do you often find yourself voting on the basis of your fears rather than your hopes? And why? Why does fear move us so powerfully? The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And last but not least, we've already opened a blog entry on this topic, and you can go to our blog and leave a comment for the world to see.
Our guest is Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea.
So, Corey, fear obviously moves us. It obviously moves us in powerful ways. And I wonder if you think, just to focus on the nature of fear and its ability to move us for a bit, is that a good thing or a bad thing to be moved by fear? What's your thought about that?
Well, I think it's an inevitable thing. So in that sense, I'm not sure it's good or bad. The fact is that the world, there are, you know, harmful, dangerous things in the world, and we can't just wave them away. And you know, the hope is that we can recognize things that are genuinely harmful to us and act accordingly, and not worry about the things that are not so harmful.
But I guess the old-fashioned liberal or lefty in me or something thinks that, you know, the fear of the white majority of the black hordes moving into their suburbs and their schools and all the policies that they put up and the barriers they put up to the advancement of African Americans over time, just out of that fear, that was a distorting, irrational thing, and that a politics devoid of that would have been better. I mean, it's not just a neutral thing. You tend to say,
yeah,
it's a neutral thing.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily irrational or distorting in that event. I mean, white people did actually have something to lose from the advancement of black people. I don't think people were acting irrationally. They were going to lose status and position, and people who have status and position and privilege and power don't like to give it up. I don't think there's anything particularly irrational about that. I think what we want to engage in that discussion is whether or not that's a justified thing, whether or not that's a right thing to want to hold on to, or whether or not the world would be a better place if we were more equal. And so this is, I think, is the real guts of the issue, is not whether or not it's fear versus no fear, but whether or not it's a legitimate fear or something that is an illegitimate fear. From a moral point of view, from a political point of view. And that would be the point that I'd want to stress. You know, just the slaveholder, for instance, he had a lot to fear from giving up his power to his slaves. So it wasn't irrational. It wasn't
Wait a minute. But if you think that a more rational order is a more order that respects human equality and individuality and human rights and all that sort of stuff, and the fear of losing one's privilege, that's some kind of distortion of the moral order. If you think the moral order is somehow grounded on reason, then you think it's not rational, that these fears are the dark voice of emotion clouding clouding rational decision making. And you might think that one of the points about liberal social democracy is that it has all these structures in place to not let emotion rule the day, to let reason more have a greater chance of ruling the day. I mean, what do you think of that thought?
Right. I mean, it depends on what you mean by rational, I think, is probably what we're getting into. And I meant it really in the sense that whether or not it's a response to something that actually exists in the world, whether it's a sort of, when we think of something that's emotional, we think of it as usually something that's a response to something that is actually not there, or something that's more fantasized in our heads or something of that sort. I was just using it in a more generic sense. But I agree with you that if you want to talk about rational in a different sense and whether or not a moral order or a political order can be rationally justified, then you're moving into a terrain that makes more sense of what you're all saying. But I do think it's important to hold on to the more commonsensical sense of the term, because we oftentimes think that, you know, to take it back to the case of white flight and things of that, that this was somehow or another something that was just conjured up in people's heads. And I think that for people who make that argument, they end up overlooking just real social facts that are tremendously important and hugely significant.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good point. And I think just as we tend to use fear, or politicians tend to use fear, it's also common, and maybe this is something that affects the left more than the right, I'm not sure, to accuse others of using fear of one thing when they actually sometimes are sincerely claiming to be fearful of something more noble. I mean, take gun control. I mean, that looks to me just like Hobbes writ large. On the one hand, mm-hmm. you have people who say, look, I don't want my neighbors to have guns. I don't want all these people in the world to have the ability to kill me from 100 yards away if they want to. And the other side says, no, we need the Second Amendment because of fear of a tyranny. If you look at mm-hmm. the terrible things that happened in the 20th century, they didn't come from individuals having guns. They came from governments.
Right. And I think what you're pointing to, if I could just jump in there, is mm-hmm. that behind many fears is a certain moral vision of the world and how the world ought to operate. So for people who don't believe in gun control, they have a notion that, a well-defended population is one where people actually take these kinds of matters into their own hands and possess their own firearms and defend themselves. And to take that away represents a real threat. I don't happen to agree with that, but that has to be argued on its merits. It can't be just fear on one side, reason on the other.
But wait a minute. So, okay, I get that. But so now it sounds like politics is a war over competing fears of who has the most power to, prevent the things they fear and make the things. I mean, it's just like it's very Hobbesian certain sense.
Hobbes is the first chapter of that book. He certainly influenced my thinking on that. I think that's because I think that's accurate. I think it's because it's not that it's a competing war over fears. I guess what it'd say is that we have competing moral visions. We don't agree upon what's good and what's bad. That's just a modern fact of life. And that's going to produce very different senses of what is evil and what is good, and therefore what is threatening and what's not threatening. People are going to be divided about that. And I think that is that's what essentially what a democracy is a contest over those battles. And we would just be a lot more honest with ourselves and have a lot better sense of the way the world works if we could come to terms with that, as opposed to thinking again that, you know, we could either have a fearless polity or a fearful polity. And I don't think that that's the way it works.
So I have a comment, then I'm going to read two email comments we've gotten. My comment is, you know, it's hard to tell a difference between hopes and fears as motivation sometimes. I mean, look at our founding fathers. We mainly now look back and say, isn't this great that they were motivated by this tremendous vision? But if you go through the Bill of Rights or the clauses in the Constitution, fear was a major motivator. I mean, they feared democracy. That's the reason they put this crazy institution, the Senate, into the Constitution. The Bill of Rights were mostly based on fears of losing things that they felt as British citizens they should have had a right to. So hope and fear, it's kind of two sides of the same coin sometimes. Now, Paul in San Francisco says, could Corey please talk about the relationship between fear and risk? Fear seems to be the emotional effect of risk. And Lewis in San Francisco says, could you guys get into legitimate fears based on the recent healthcare debate? So there's a palette of things you can talk about, Corey.
Well, I'll take your comment first. I think you're absolutely right that the framers were very much mixed of hope and fears. I mean, one of the most influential political theorists on that generation was Montesquieu, who was one of the early formulators of a politics of fear and the centrality of fear to political life. So you're absolutely right. And the larger point you're making about the mixture of hope and fear, I think, is also true. I mean, that FDR quote that everybody talks about goes right to that. It's a hopefulness that's grounded in the overcoming of fear. The fear and risk question, risk is a sort of fundamental fact of life, and people make calculations about it. And, you know, insurance industry, the whole insurance industry is built upon those calculations about it. And the thing that we know about risk is that people's risk and the risks that they're willing to take is not always a function or a response to the actual level of danger. That there's a whole set of calculations and oftentimes moral calculations that go into the things that people are willing to risk, the things that they're not willing to risk. So, for instance, people, you know, are willing to get into a car, which is, of course, one of the most dangerous things you could do from a risk point of view, but because they sense they feel like they have more control over that instrument, they're willing to undertake that.
But see, part of the point about that is that a fear-driven politics often makes us overestimate risk, way overestimate risk. And there's psychological studies that people's calculation of risk and reward, and we are really bad at this. And a fear-driven politics makes vivid the risk, but not often the, in one sense, the badness, but not the real probabilities of some terrible thing occurring. And we way overestimate the probability to make these decisions that are not very well grounded in sort of. But you know, I want to let some callers into this conversation, too. The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And we've got a caller in the line now, Evan in Pinole.
Yeah,
welcome
hi.
To Philosophy Talk, Evan.
Hi. Yeah, I want to make a comment and get your feedback. I think that in some way you're overstating the case for fear. I mean, I think the reason that I choose vanilla over chocolate, let's say, chocolate ice cream, is not because I fear what chocolate's going to do to me, but it's a desire or a preference. I think you can have a choice based on an aversion, but without fear. I mean, to me, fear is a very specific emotion. I didn't want Bush to go into Iraq to start the Iraq War, not because I had some kind of fear, but because as far as I'm concerned, I didn't feel fear. I felt that it was a stupid thing to do. I felt more disgust than anything else. So to say, I mean, to me it sounds like you're saying that anything that you're averse to is based on fear. That seems way too
bad. Evan, I certainly don't want to say that, and I doubt that you want to say that, Corey. Am I right about that?
No, not at all. Okay. But I think the important point, though, is we talked about Hobbes. Earlier, and Hobbes said that what fear is the aversion of future evil. It has that component of it. And so there's an aversive component in fear, but I think your caller is absolutely right that not all aversion is fear. Something else has to be added to it, but we have to remind ourselves that there is something cognitive inside that emotion, that it's not just a not completely non-cognitive emotion.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Evan. That was an important point. But okay, so, but I want to press that. What else is there to fear than aversion to future unpleasantness or something like that? Is it something more visceral? I mean, is that what makes fear so powerful?
Yeah, I mean, there's an affect that's associated with it oftentimes. But when we talk about, and certainly that can be very obvious at the sort of individual level, but when we talk about the politics of fear, I think we have to be careful there because, you know, people use that as a shorthand phrase. And I'm not sure that, I mean, even the sort of the aftermath of 9/11, you know, was everybody sitting there shaking and trembling with fear? You know, in the sense that, all, you know, if you think of your worst nightmare or the things that really make you afraid. For me, I'm terrified of flying. And there I really am shaking with fear. When we talk about a politics of fear, it's not always clear that that's what we mean by the politics of fear. It's oftentimes that the rhetoric of fear and the sort of the ideological trappings of fear are dominating a public agenda. I think that's more often what we mean by that term.
I think I take your point. I think you have a point. But I do think there is, at least after 9/11, I don't know about you, but I felt a kind of enduring anxiety every time. So remember the anthrax scare and all that? Mm-hmm. Every time there was another report, my anxiety level went up, right? And I felt myself being manipulatable by the political structures in more ways, subject to manipulation, you know, open to being manipulated in more ways than previously, right? Willing to countenance more things than I otherwise would have been.
Right. What's interesting about that is that, and this is anecdotal, so I wouldn't want to push the point too far, but my sense is that people who actually lived in New York City, which I did at the time, I mean, I still do, felt less of what you're talking about. And I've always had the sense, and I just raised this hypothetically, that there's something about the further distance you are from these types of events, from the reality of the danger you're actually confronting, that the more fear you feel. Edmund Burke in The Sublime and the Beautiful made a similar argument that somehow proximity, the nearness to the actual object of danger, it creates a sense of familiarity and knowingness, and it bounds the danger and it makes it more knowable, and therefore it diminishes the fear that you have.
Yeah, but I do
and
think
that somehow
I do think ahead. Though that the political class, I'm not saying rightly or wrongly, used our diminished sense of security, our increased anxiety as a way to frame what should we be doing now. I think that was a powerful moment in American history. But, you know, we're listening to Philosophy Talk. We'd love to have more input from our callers, 1-800-525-9917. And we've got a caller on the line now, James from Palo Alto. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, James.
Hi. I was wondering if you could comment on the Tea Party movement in the sense of, do they bring up any legitimate fears, even if the rhetoric's a little overheated?
Okay. What do you think, Corey? Thanks, James.
I don't personally think so, because I think the object of the fear, the thing that they're talking about, is an overweening government that stifles freedom. I see the logic of the argument, but I actually think they have a mistaken notion of freedom, basically, that they see the primary threat to freedom, at least in this country, from the government involved in any kind of activity. And I think there's very little evidence to support that. But again, I mean, I see the logic of the argument there. It's just that it really depends on your estimation of what ultimately is more threatening or not. So
it's a
Go ahead. It seems to me that it's kind of complicated. I mean, what was really should have been a debate about health insurance and regulation of health insurance companies was pitched partly because of Obama as a reform of health care. And I think the idea of the federal government being in charge of health care is quite frightening. Now, it may be irrelevant, but I think a lot of Tea Party people have been reacting to the fear of the federal government having a lot to do with their health care. That seems to me a legitimate fear given the way the thing was presented. It wasn't health care reform, it was health insurance reform.
But maybe it was purposely presented by some as a takeover over health care just to stoke those fears. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing fear with Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea.
We've been talking about the ways in which fear can influence and distort political discourse. In our next segment, we'll ask whether we could have such discourse without the use of fear.
Toward a fearless politics? When Philosophy Talk continues. What can I do?
I scare myself, and I don't mean lightly. I scare myself.
The topic, fear. The speaker, John Perry, the program Philosophy Talk, the one that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Corey Robin, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea. And we've got a caller on the line now, Marsha from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marsha.
Hi.
What's Good your comment
show.
Or question?
Good show.
Well, thank you.
To a certain extent, you can determine whether you are fearful. And the example I would choose is, I know people who have 5 locks on their front doors. And I think that it intensifies their fear each time they have to unlock 5 locks to get in and out of their door. I have 1 lock. It's a good lock. And I really think that it reduces the impact of fear on my life.
Well, that's a good technique, Marsha. What do you think of that, Gori? Is that a
I couldn't agree with that more. Actually, I've long felt that, you know, a lot of the security that you have to go through at the airport, far from making people actually feel calmer, actually exacerbates their anxiety as they're going through, and unclear what the payoffs are of that. But I think clearly, with the example that the caller is talking about, ultimately people are terrified of these sorts of things, and they do all these, take all these measures to do, you know, to stop it, but it doesn't allay their anxiety.
But that makes a more general point I want to raise, and I don't know if this is a challenge to your way of looking at it or not. So look, we face a certain threat that somebody might break into our house, right? And so we need to take, or that our property values might go down, or that there might be another attack. We face a certain threat. We need to respond to that threat. There are things that we can do that will respond to the threat as reasonably as we can, like put a lock on our door. But we put these, we do these other things that make us, A, overestimate the threat and increase our anxiety. Put five locks on our door, right? Every time we have to open these five locks, we get more and more anxious because we think, oh my God, there's really these breakers and enterers. They're really, you know, they're really terrible guys. I mean, isn't there, I mean, the threat and the aversion is one thing, but increasing our anxiety, is that a reasonable thing to do?
No, not at all. I think...
But I didn't hear in what you were telling us earlier any kind of criticism of the increased anxiety. You know, whites feel all this anxiety because their property values are going to go down and they take all these actions. The slaveholder has all this anxiety because he's going to lose his property. I mean, what... Mm-hmm. Right. I mean,
you see, I guess the point I would make is that the problem there is not the emotion per se, that the fact that they have all this anxiety. The problem is that they're is the world that they imagine that they want to live in, one in which they have power versus one in which they share power. I think that's the real it's the underlying assessment of the world that I want to get at. It's not the fact that they're so scared of one world versus another world. That's, I think, the point that I was trying to stress.
Corey, I want to get into the idea of the possibility of a politics not based on fear, but let me get to that by asking you about universities. You might think that universities are a good example of a society that can make politics, can make decisions, let's just say, with a minimum of politics and a minimum of fear. I mean, you've got very intelligent people. The most powerful people are the tenured professors who tend to be older and wiser, like me and Ken. But you obviously don't think that's true. How does fear percolate up in the university?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're right that you would think that it wouldn't be a place where that happened. But I would have to say I've rarely met a more timid bunch of people than university professors, particularly those who are tenured. I think that and I am a tenured professor, so I include myself there. I'm not trying to exclude myself there. But I think that in any system, particularly one like a university, that it's so stratified with so many with such a pecking order, where there's things that people want, you know, whether it's tenure, and if you're tenure, then it's something else beyond that. It's an endowed chair. There's always something else to be gotten. And I think people are very scared of not getting those or of losing that which they have. And I think that makes them particularly timid.
So, we played that Bill Clinton quote in which he was talking about, if one candidate's appealing to your hopes and another's appealing to your fears, try to vote for the one who's appealing to your hopes and wants you to think rather than the one who's appealing to your fears and wants you to merely feel, I guess. It sounds to me like you think... I mean, maybe it's about one person's hope is another person's fear. My hope for freedom is his fear of losing his property. Is politics bound to be about, you know, the adjudication between fear and hope? Could we really, you know, could we have this thing of a fearless politics?
I don't think so, honestly. Like I said, I think ultimately in politics, fear is a function of the differential of power. And I think you can try to reduce that differential of power to try to make things more and more equal. But of course, in order to do that, you're going to have government intervention to make sure that things stay equal. And then it's going to require more and more power on the government. And then, as you brought up in your early discussion at the beginning of this segment, then you have the question of the government becoming an object of fear. And I think that's a permanent, enduring tension. I don't think it can be resolved. I think what you can do is to try to sort of engage in that struggle and try to keep at it. But I would also say we're a far, far way from getting there. So I don't think we have anything to fear on that score for quite a while.
So we got a caller in the line who wants to come in on this point, I think. Arthur from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Arthur.
Hi, Ken. I just wanted to comment with regards to the concept of politicians using fear as their agenda. Well, to me, I think the reason why they use it is because of accountability issues, that we just don't hold them accountable enough when they make comments, whether or not it is about climate change, healthcare reform, or war in Iraq. I think we just take it as for granted, and they can just make these comments without us, a society, holding them accountable for it. What do you guys think about that?
Well, thanks, Arthur. Thanks for the call. I'm not sure, because if I read you right, Corey, I mean, you think this is just the inevitable. Look, It's what's going to happen and what isn't going to happen. Who's going to have power? Who isn't going to have power? And the loss of power is a fearful thing. The gain of power is a thing you hope for. So it's bound to be. And the politician who says, you're going to lose out if those folks get this thing, he's not fear-mongering. He's pointing out the facts. And then the fear just follows. So I think you, is there anything critical to say on your view about this use of fear, this political use of fear, Corey?
Yeah. I mean, I think what's critical about it is that, again, you have to interrogate whether or not, even if you are going to lose power and are afraid of that, whether or not there are not some other countervailing values that are equally important, or if not more important. And I think that would be the point that I would stress is that I think most people believe or claim to believe that they want to live in a democratic society, and that the certain vision they have of holding on to their power is inconsistent with that. If they don't believe that, I think you're going to be in a tougher time trying to persuade them otherwise. But that would be the critical point that I would want to interrogate would be just what's the underlying moral vision that you have there, and whether or not that can ultimately be justified. But in order to do that, you have to first start by acknowledging the reality that, yes, you will lose something, but that might not, in the end, be a terrible thing. It might actually be ultimately a good thing. But I don't think you're going to get there if you skip over that step.
So in current American politics, it seems to me the worst fear mongering is probably not from politicians, but from Fox News people like Glenn Beck. And just to be even handed, we can also say that Keith Olbermann is over the line a lot. Although there, I think it's pomposity that's really irritating, yeah. Not the appeal to fear. And with respect to the caller, what do we do about that? What are the consequences? Well, the consequences in both cases are being made fun of by John Stewart. You know, within the process, that's a really, I don't know if it's not as effective as Franco or Hitler, closing down a radio station. But that's our way of doing it. It's just constantly try to meet the illegitimate use of fear with the truth. And hopefully the truth delivered in effective ways like John Stewart does.
But, Corey, I think there's something deep that I wish we had more time to get to because we're about at the end of our conversation with you. But, look, classical liberalism thinks that we have to have this conception, this kind of shared conception of justice that abstracts away from the differences between us. Democracy is about maximum buy-in. So things that divide us, right, we kind of set them aside and try to get this overlapping consensus kind of thing, you know, where we can all agree, and that's the content of our political life. You seem to think that that's an illusion. I mean, people don't operate like that, right? People want the goodies. They want power. And to have a politics in light of that is a real challenging thing that it's not clear that liberalism has lived up to, how challenging politics is. Is that your thought?
Absolutely. And I would actually say that democracy is precisely not about the shelving of those conflicts, but about the deep immersion in them. And that, again, the greatest advances of democracy, the most democratic moments in this country that everybody would agree upon, most people would agree upon, the emancipation of slaves, the gaining of power for workers and women and then blacks in the 1950s and 60s, those were moments of deep, intense conflict and confrontation that were about the overcoming of a certain kind of inhibiting, stifling fear for the sake of a greater share of the promise of American life.
Yeah, well, that's both an uplifting and a bracing thought, because a kind of wimpy liberalism thinks that we could just reason together and get to all these problems, and it doesn't really understand the deep-seated nature of our fears of one another, I think. If you agree with that.
I do.
Okay. So on that note of agreement, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Corey Robin. He's professor of political science at the City University of New York, author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea. So, John, you got any final thoughts today?
Well, one thing I wish we'd gotten into more is how fear of not other people within our society, but of foreign governments is often used in American politics. Maybe not even so much consciously, but it has shaped a lot of our destiny, the idea that we have a lot to fear from the rest of the world. And I'm not saying that we don't have a lot to fear from the rest of the world, but it's really because I think the federal government can so easily do things on the international level, and it's so hard to do anything on a national level because of the setup of Congress. That's a natural. It's a very powerful mechanism in our national culture.
Oh, I guess I think you're totally right. I mean, we always seem to have But partly because the world makes it so, we always seem to have the other nation, right? Hitler, Stalin, China, now the Islamic fundamentalists, the other, right? Fear of the other to mobilize and organize us. And that's, I think, a deep thing about our politics. But you know, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog. It's already started on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago. And also go to our Facebook page, our lively Facebook page. We're well over 4,000 members now, so...
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. Now for the final word, we turn to the fastest talking fearmonger around, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, despite living with a war on terror, we don't really live in fear, do we? There aren't bombs disguised as garbage in the street. There aren't drones dropping explosives from the sky. There aren't firefights between religious factions in front of the grocery store. By and large, we live our lives from day to day, with our only fear being the fear that we won't be among the first to acquire an iPad. Certainly we have moments of fear, the great anthrax scare, for instance, and 9/11, which left everyone within sight of a tall building, port, stadium, or transportation hub more than a little jumpy. One such moment of fear, long before the War on Terror, occurred back in 1938 when Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater performed their Halloween special radio adaptation of H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity.
The news bulletin style of the program persuaded some listeners that Martians really had landed in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Many of those listeners missed the disclaimer at the top of the show. They tuned in late because they were listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy on another network. Others apparently believe that if Orson Welles is saying it, it must be true. Of course, radio was coming into its own as a scary medium. The Lindbergh baby kidnapping captured the nation's attention in 1932. In 1937, the nation heard the eyewitness account of the crash of the Hindenburg. Just weeks before the War of the Worlds aired, broadcasts from Nazi Germany alerted the world that Hitler had annexed Austria and part of Czechoslovakia. During September 1938, more radios were sold in America than any previous month. People were jittery.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water.
But how big was the War of the Worlds panic? In his book, Terror on the Air, Horror Radio in America, Richard J. Hand cites studies which calculated that some 6 million heard the CBS program, 1.7 million believed it to be true, and 1.2 million were genuinely frightened. Well, I don't see how 500,000 people can believe it to be true and not be frightened, but let that go. The frightened number is still only about 20% of listeners, and most of them just made phone calls to see what was going on. Nobody died of fright or was killed. There were no suicides. Emergency room visits did not spike. There were no citizens screaming in the streets. One famous photograph of a farmer with a gun ready to shoot aliens turned out to have been staged by Life magazine. According to some reports, so many panicked people converged at Grover's Mill that police were summoned to control them. Well, I find that unlikely. If you believed a news report that aliens with tentacles and death rays had invaded New Jersey, would you consider it a travel destination? Honey, they're disintegrating people in Jersey. Pack a lunch and let's go. Inside a month, however, there were over 12,000 newspaper articles either about the broadcast or the panic. So maybe there wasn't a panic. Maybe it was just created by the media. If there was fear, it was fear by the newspapers that radio might make them obsolete. The War of the Worlds provided a great opportunity for yellow journalism to exaggerate the dangers of this upstart broadcast medium. Newspapers, of course, survived radio, only to be vaporized by the death rays of the Internet. And why aren't we afraid of that? Because it's not just New Jersey. The tentacles of the Internet are everywhere.
The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.